There's no sexy voice this time, but we do have a guest, and I couldn't imagine having a better one. Welcome to Ace Pod 1.2. It's insane that this is the first time we've been sitting in the same room together.
Exactly.
Because we have more connections than I think people even realize from those of people who follow us on Twitter. But I get to introduce University of Michigan class of 2009, alum of the Michigan Review, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Every Day Should Be Saturday, SB Nation NFL, and MTV News, the late great MTV News, with bylines in the likes of the New York Times, Washington Post, ESPN, and The Ringer. Currently a senior politics reporter at Vox, covering a lot of stuff that we're going to stay very far away from today. A frequent co-host of Vox's The Weeds podcast, a happy Cincinnati Bengals divorcee, first ballot Michigan Twitter Hall of Fame inductee, creator of the All-PI offense, and person most likely to aptly compare a Michigan football game to the Battle of Stalingrad.
True.
Jan Costin.
Thank you so much for having me. We will absolutely not discuss politics.
Yes,
I'm extremely excited about that.
We are staying as far away from that as possible. There have been events this weekend that have been an absolute horror show to talk about.
Nope, not going to do it.
Jane had a mildly harrowing Uber drive because the Uber driver knew her profession. So, that's always a roll of the dice that you don't want to take.
I think that that's one of the things I always tell people, that the best thing I can think of to do when you're starting in journalism is to start out actually in sports, because people will never get angrier at me than they did when I was covering the NFL.
Like, yeah.
Outraged. Because people want to people now email me like attempting to change my mind, or just be like, well, if you just read this, you would totally understand why 9/11 was caused by Israel.
Which is a thing to pretty easily shunt off to the
side. Yeah, but like sports mad, it's like, you know, I have a friend who he talked about, he used to cover like high school football, and he was like, I'll never get angrier letters than I will from the parents of high school football players.
Oh, yeah.
Who are just like, how dare you not mention my son's like one interception in a game they lost by 30.
I'm honestly still not sure if I'm welcome back at Toledo Whitmer because of a pretty positive scouting report on Chris Wormley.
Not even
Chris Wormley, who follows me on Twitter, took the wrong way, but somebody else got real mad.
Oh, man. Chris Wormley, good dude. Great swim move.
Yes. Also was a bouncer at the Arc, which I discovered while walking by the Arc one summer and seeing Chris Wormley standing there in the Arc polo, and it was an exceptionally orderly line
to get into this concert. Oh, I absolutely bet it was. I really think that, like, more Michigan defensive players should serve as bouncers, because I feel like you wouldn't even, like, I'm thinking of like when I was there and just imagining, I mean, Morgan Trent would have been a terrible bouncer.
Yeah, Morgan Trent would not have been a good bouncer.
You'd just wind up in the completely wrong place. You'd be like, what? I thought I was trying to get into this bar and somehow I'm in a park next door. How'd that happen? I know Morgan Trent is a delightfully, like, he's a great person and he's doing really well in his life, and yet I'm still incredibly mad at him.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've got, like, an exceptionally long list of Michigan players from that era where it's, like, between, like, 2007 and 2010, it's like, yeah, like, lovely person. Let's not discuss the football stuff.
Right, except for Leon Hall, who was both good at football and always made it to our 8:30 a.m. Thursday bio lecture.
Mm. Yeah, I had a class right after Chad Henne, and he would jog up and down the stairs, but he was always there on time.
Yeah, I once saw Chad Henne in Ulrich's bookstore, and I was like, "Well, this is my only time to ever look at Chad Henne." And his girlfriend at the time was there, and she was staring at me like, "Why are you looking at my boyfriend?" I'm like, "No, no, no, this isn't creepy at all." But he didn't blink for a solid 3.5 minutes.
Oh no, he's a robot.
He was not real, and I was like, "Oh, that explains everything." Like the whole like executevictory.exe, like, yeah, no, he was a robot. It's remarkable.
Yeah, the fact that he tripped on the way out of Spartan Stadium and still got up and slapped the tunnel, it's like, yeah, no, he had to complete that.
Yeah, yep.
That directive.
Exactly.
All right, so speaking of this as a safe place, and because, like, this is going to go on the MGO blog feed, and before we go completely off the rails, which
exactly.
I'm super, super excited to do.
Exactly.
This is a Michigan basketball safe space.
Yes.
And I was a little bit concerned because, Michigan's, coming off a little bit of a funky loss. But then Michigan State, like, totally redeems everything by losing at Indiana.
Which I think...
Or losing to Indiana at Breslin, which is even better.
Yeah, no, and especially losing in overtime, and then Izzo being like, well, I saw this coming. I kind of saw this coming because I couldn't seem to get them to play the way I wanted to in practice. Which I was just like, you're Tom fucking Izzo. Like, I think that you can persuade many people who you have... Like, let's go through, like, the recruiting process. Like, he has known these players for what? Like... If you're a freshman, he's been watching you for, like, the last three-something years.
Yeah, 3 or 4 years,
like,
probably.
I think you can probably persuade them to beat Indiana at home.
Yes, like, an Indiana team that lost Juwan Morgan, like, 13 minutes into this game.
Exactly. And, you know, after watching the Michigan play at Assembly Hall, which used to be, like, the fucking Terror Dome.
Yes.
Which, ironically, I think that them being the Terror Dome also corresponded with Tom Crean being coach. Which, side note, I only just found out that I was watching SEC basketball, which I don't do often.
Because why would anybody do
and
that?
Then I'm like, Tom Crean coaches at Georgia now.
Yes.
And yet it's the exact same Tom Crean. He's still gathering his pants excitedly. He got very upset about a no call. And I think, like, there was a shove under the basket. And I was like... It's like nothing changed.
Yeah. I mean, even like the jersey colors are the same. It's
I
like
know.
You squint a little bit and it's like, I mean, the basketball is definitely worse, but like that sure is a Tom Crean team, right?
Exactly.
There.
But no, I felt much, I mean, I think we're getting into that stage of Big Ten basketball at which, like, you know, I said this during, I think I said it on Twitter during the Minnesota game. Like, I turned it on and was like, I know where this is going. And the nowhere it was going is nowhere good. Like, I was like, yeah, we're going to either win this on a buzzer beater or we're going to lose in overtime, one of the two.
And sure enough, a buzzer beater gotten off with, like, a quarter of a second before
you know
the
what?
Shot clock
you
is
know
fired.
What? I was very impressed by the number of Minnesota fans who, one, were Minnesota fans, and two,
yeah.
were like, but his fingers were still on the bottom. But calm down. Like... You and Richard Pitino just go calm down somewhere else. But yeah, I think we're at the stage of the Big Ten season in which everyone's really tired of each other.
Yes.
And I think it's good, obviously, for Indiana because I think based on kind of the conversations that have been happening within kind of the Indiana fan base, they were starting to get extremely nervous about kind of the Archie Miller.
Oh, they're
tenure.
Like they're like pining after Tom Crean on Crimson Quarry right now.
Which that's don't pine.
I love it.
I know. I know you love it, but like don't do it.
It's a bad place that they're in right now.
No, it's not.
I've been there. I mean,
you start,
in a similar
you start
place
saying,
where Michigan football was.
You start
it's not
saying
good.
Things you just don't really mean.
Yes.
You start using terms you just don't really intend to. But yeah, it's also funny to me that like winning at Breslin is something that, you know, it's extremely difficult to do, but I think once you get this particular Michigan State team into kind of that, like, dogfight overtime time, like, you shouldn't win those games based on who this Michigan State team is, and the fact that Indiana was able to, after, like, the Indiana we saw back at Assembly Hall.
Well, and also, like, the Indiana, towards the end of that game, like, they gacked up so many chances to win it. It's like, why is this game in overtime in the first place?
No,
there's no way they're winning this.
No, it makes no sense. I mean, again, college basketball makes no sense, which I've actually, I've realized that the best way forward for sanity, for me personally, is that if there's a Michigan basketball game that's supposed to happen on a Friday, I'm like, I'll find out about it later. Like, I watched some of this Iowa game, and because it was on at a bar, and I just was like, why would you put this on television to just show people? Why would you do that? That's disgusting.
Putting people through this like that.
That's terrible. But no, it does make me feel better because I think that, you know, at this point in my Michigan fandom, my biggest instinct is towards the desiring of suffering of others.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I want other people to feel bad. I don't need to always feel good. I recognize that's too much.
Yeah.
But other people should feel suffering, like, and pain. That's what I want.
Yeah, no, I, like, the moment that the Michigan State-Indiana game ended, it was like, yeah, that was totally worth the Iowa loss.
Oh, yeah.
Like, tell me that we chalk one of them to each team, and, like, yeah, I will take that. That's a net win.
Yep. Nope, that sounds good. I feel like that should go in, like, the new, whatever, like, the net standings. Like, there should also be, like, did a team you fucking hate lose? Yeah.
On the same weekend? Did. Okay, that negates the loss. Like, you're good.
Yeah.
Yeah, we need a petty factor in the net rankings.
Pettiness is genuinely why I'm in college basketball at all. Like, just
Absolutely.
Having, like, really old art. I mean, I think that SB Nation, they have this wonderful video series that's about like historical beefs.
Yeah, and beef history is a wonderful
series. I keep
series.
Recommending new beefs. Like, I keep, you know, when Aretha Franklin passed away, I really, really wanted them to do a beef history of Aretha Franklin, because Aretha Franklin beefed really hard in almost sports-like terms with just... Yes. Numerous people just...
She was not afraid of upstaging people and then telling them exactly what she felt about them.
I mean, nor should she have been, because she was Aretha Franklin.
Yes.
But I also think that there should be more... I mean, they do have a ton of NBA beefs, because, I mean, obviously there's a lot, like, you could just... The Chris Paul-Rondo beef that just goes on, that has been going on for a long-ass time.
Which is, like, a totally inexplicable, like, why is, like...
I mean,
I didn't even really know that beef is, like, I follow the NBA quite closely, and, like, I wasn't even really aware that that beef existed, but it's like, wait a minute, like, this is a real thing. Like, Rajon Rondo, like, thinks he's on that level with Chris Paul, where, like, there's a beef between these two
dudes.
And
then Rondo just keeps bringing up, like, well, I won a title and you didn't, and I'm like,
like, look at the teammates or whatever, but...
Like, you know, technically, legally, that's true.
Yes.
Like, under... Legally, that is indeed what took place, but I still wouldn't start...
But, like, Darko can make the same argument with Charles Barkley, and,
it's true.
You know.
I mean, I would actually love to see that happen.
I would really enjoy
Again,
it.
Again, a beef I wish had happened. That would have been amazing.
Neither guy seems to... seems like they'd shy away from a bar fight.
Indeed. Indeed. No, I really enjoy the beef history, but I really do want, like, college basketball beef history, because then you could just have, like, college coaches who have, like... You know, basically, like, the entire college basketball establishment versus John Calipari.
Yes.
Like, when ESPN did that documentary about John Calipari, which I kind of think John Calipari made. Because,
like,
it
co-produced.
Makes... Yeah, because I was like, you look, like, basically it just keeps being like, oh, you know, he just does things a different way, and he's so great, and everybody loves him. And I'm like, that's not how I remember John Calipari.
Yeah, I don't seem to remember anybody talking about him that way, except maybe John Calipari.
Yeah, and I'm just like, you know, and his explanation of like, well, you know, each place I was before Kentucky, I just had to leave for reasons that, you know, have nothing to do with all of those wins being vacated. Like, I'm just...
nothing to do with somehow getting Marcus Camby to play for UMass.
Which, now having actually been to the campus of UMass, I'm even more impressed by. deep apologies to UMass listeners, but you know it's true.
All, I think zero of them on this podcast.
Exactly. I don't know. I low-key occasionally meet people who are like, whoa. I'm a giant, like, UConn Stores fan. I'm like, really?
Like, for sure?
Are you, all right. I mean,
fair
whatever
enough.
You're into.
And you've listened to me apparently talk crap about you.
Yeah, I mean, of all the, like, rivalries that I'm, like, concerned about, I think... Anyone in the northeast of the United States, I'm not that worried about.
Yeah, no, that's probably...
Like, I mean, you probably have decent public transportation and some things to do, and it's cold.
So, like it's not a throwdown area.
No,
It's not like it got too hot out here, and we're taking everything very personally.
No, this is not like HBCU marching band territory. You know, that's somewhere I will never go.
Yeah.
I don't want to start anything there.
No, thank you.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, like, it'd be like starting a fight in, like, Michigan this week.
No.
Like, no one, like, unless you could, like, kill a member of my family in front of me this week, and it'd be like, well, it really depends on the family member right now. Like,
no, it's
which
very,
one is that again?
It's very funny to be up here now, because it's now, like, 45 degrees, and I've seen three people wearing shorts, and I was like, that's the school I know.
This is Ann Arbor.
I feel at home.
Yeah.
Also, everyone...
It was Hoth 2 days ago,
and
people are wearing shorts.
Oh, yeah, because it's... You know, I remember I had a friend when we were in college who had something he called Pink Shorts Day, which is basically the second it got over 50, he would wear shorts. His, like, pink, like, whatever that salmon color shorts.
Oh, yeah.
And he would just, like, and I was like, aren't you?
They give you one when you get into a fraternity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And he was like, it's Pink Shorts Day. It's just what we got to do. And it was amazing because everybody else would be kind of like, you know, you'd see some girls wearing, like, tank tops. And I'm like, just to be clear, it's 50 degrees.
Yeah.
If it were this temperature in October, you'd be wearing a sweater and a sweatshirt.
It's all relative in Michigan.
Oh,
I worked at the Michigan Union for a long time, and, you know, they've got, like, all the place in the basement, including, at least when I was there, like, this ridiculous smoothie place.
I remember. I also remember the temperature in that basement was always, like, 900 degrees?
Yeah, somewhere between 900 and 4,000. And, yeah, like, every year, first day, it was 50 degrees. Yeah. I'd be out on the front steps of the Michigan Union after my shift with the biggest slushie I could have.
Right.
And probably wearing shorts.
Yep. Yep. And then
you... At best, a long sleeve t-shirt. And that... Though, and at no point do you feel cold.
No, though.
If I did that in October, I'd be frigid. Like, right, I do not run warm.
No. Though I do like knowing, there was actually a Wall Street Journal piece about this, in which they actually went out and were like, hey, people wearing shorts in Minnesota this week. Why are you wearing shorts? And then, well, I just run really hot, but I don't really notice cold. And I'm like, no, that's not true. But I love that in every cold weather area.
You're putting yourself in your mindset.
Right. In every cold weather area, there are people who wear shorts and there are people who want to ask questions of those people. And I really appreciate both sides of that conversation.
Yeah, because I had one of my friends growing up would wear not just shorts, but Birkenstocks, and old Birkenstocks. Birkenstocks so old that he had worn completely through them. And he would wear this all year, 365 days a year. And it's just like, some point people stop asking, like, how do your feet survive? Because it's just like, I mean, they're still there.
Right, they're still attached to his person.
And this is a person who, like... He wears this, so you're not going to get a coherent answer of, like, anything. Like, the reasons, why even bother asking?
No.
Like, it's like, you just go with it at that point.
I feel as if, though, that's the kind of decision one makes. Like, I'm married.
Mm-hmm.
I am not allowed to make decisions like that anymore, and that's for the best, because...
Because someone's looking out for you.
That is part of marriage. Like, you sign a lot of paperwork, and you make a lot of promises, and one of the promises is... Someone else is going to be like, why on earth are you wearing Birkenstocks and shorts? It's 40 degrees. What are you doing? And I really appreciate that about, like, you know, the bonds of marriage, which is in part someone keeping you from doing the stupid shit you would do if you could. But you shouldn't do those things.
Yeah. And meanwhile, I get the flip side, which is my perpetual bachelordom has allowed me to rack up a bunch of moments that I've aired out on this podcast that, like, people should not discuss in public forums.
Nope.
But,
Nope. Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Not at all.
But I just roll right through it. Because nobody's there to tell me to stop.
I will tell you to stop. But
I know. We're not bringing up Ken Pom.
Nope.
We're not bringing up Ken Pom.
Never again.
There's not going to be any soul music on this podcast.
Nope.
We'll just do Rage Against the Machine.
Perfect.
And, like, the Midsummer Murders theme.
Exactly.
Which, I think this was enough of a basketball podcast, we can now dive right into that.
Perfect.
For people who are not familiar with Midsummer Murders, I feel like we have to give a little bit of background on, like, the most incredible thing that you can see on Netflix.
It's true. So it is a British murder mystery show, and it takes place in an area, it's an imaginary place, yes. Called Midsummer County.
And thank God it's an imaginary place.
Thank God, because I think one of my favorite parts, I believe it's on the Wikipedia page, because I think it comes up in an episode, is that Midsummer County would have roughly the murder rate of, like, 1983 El Salvador.
Because that sounds about right.
It is an amazing murder mystery show. The first Barnaby is Tom Barnaby. Then it's his cousin, John Barnaby, who comes in from, I believe it's Bristol or something, somewhere on the coast.
A real place.
Yes, yeah. A real place. He comes in to replace Tom Barnaby from the coast after, like, 14 seasons. Because one of the things about British television is that you can have 21 seasons of something, but each season is 5 episodes long.
Yeah.
Because each episode's an hour and a half.
I have the IMDb page up, and John Nettles, who played Tom Barnaby... Yes. Was on the show from 1997 until 2011.
Yeah.
And appears in 81 episodes.
Yep,
which sounds like a lot, but it's like, man, you really spread that out.
You really do, because each episode
is a movie.
Each episode is a movie. And each episode, I think my favorite thing about Midsummer Murders is that it really, I think it's supposed to be like this also, is that it is an excellent exhibition of kind of the ins and outs and the inner darkness of like a specific kind of rural English culture.
Oh, absolutely.
In which people are straight up willing to kill over antiques festivals, wine. There's even a wine trebuchet. And one of the other things about Midsummer Murders is because, and I looked this up, is because of British gun laws.
Yeah.
I think there are, as far as I've seen, I think I've seen basically every episode, there have been two or three people who were shot with a gun. One of those was a really involved faked suicide.
Yeah.
And that involved a rifle. The other was also like a hunting rifle. And in general, like, no one is killed by a gun.
They get mad creative.
Oh my goodness. People
wheels of cheese.
Wheels of cheese, wine trebuchets. People get poisoned. There was someone who got sent a, giant casino game, and one of the pieces of the casino game cut her, and that poisoned her and killed her, which, again, a lot of effort.
Yeah.
A lot of effort.
These people, if there's one thing that people have in Midsummer County, it is time.
A lot of time. And it's people who are just like, there'll be an episode in which, like, there's one in which a priest, or an implied priest, murders, in one episode, I think 6 people.
Oh, yeah. Like, almost all of them are serial killers.
They're all serial killers. And at the end, they all, once, like, Tom or John Barnaby, like, ask them the right questions. They're like, well, you know, he did interrupt my bell ringing performance.
There's always a very reasonable explanation.
Oh, it's extremely for why they have reasonable. Just,
it's always, like, you have committed some cardinal sin against, like, proper midsummer, like,
right.
ways of comporting yourself, and now you must die.
A lot of people must die. I think my favorite, not a recent episode, it's one of the first, I think, 2 seasons, which, just to give you an idea, like, you're gonna start watching the show and thinking, like, oh, it's, like, tweedly English stuff, and then, no. The most recent episode I watched, it involves someone who, like, she was holding on to her brother's dead body, and, like, it was keeping it in a bed and then trying to kill the brother's wife over a period of like 20 years.
I'm pretty sure there's an incest twist in the very first episode of the entire show.
Oh, yeah. No, it is dark.
Yeah.
But also, the darkness comes from the fact that, like, they will have solved this giant murder.
Yeah.
And then they'll never discuss it again.
Yeah. No, it never. There's no continuity between it.
No,
like,
no.
There will be slight overarching plots that have to do with, like, the individual characters
right.
that are integral to the show.
Right.
But, like, just like the detective and the rotating cast of the inspectors and whatever. Or, like, he's going to have a child. Or, like, you know, he has a dog.
Yeah, a great dog.
Sykes is wonderful.
Yeah. It's a really addictive show. Also, there are many things that I've learned about the British crime and British legal system through the show. One, it is impossible to get sent to prison for anything. Like, there are so many people like, yeah, you know, he, like, stole $30,000 from someone, but, you know, we just sort of just, we're going to let that go.
Yeah, it's all, like, the crimes that they uncover as, like, red herrings to get to the real murderer. Like, wait, but, like, stop and pay attention to this guy, too. I mean, I know he didn't kill somebody necessarily, but, like, you know.
It seems bad.
Sounds like you should at least see the court.
Yeah, but also that people are like, oh, Barnaby. Like, I'm like, oh, no, this is a cop. Not just a cop. He's, like, a full-on detective. And yet people are like, I don't have to talk to you, Barnaby. Like, you big... I'm like, no. Like, maybe this is my inherent... deep concerns about the criminal justice system, but, you know, if a detective showed up in my house, I would not attempt to throw them out because he had tread upon my, like, dear late aunt's antique rug.
Well, and then there are also the people who show, like, absolutely no fear of the student. Yeah. It's like, no, man, this is Barnaby. Like, that dude has put away so many people by this point. Like, this is one of the most prolific detectives in the history of the world.
I know, which is why, like, by the time you get to kind of the end of Tom Barnaby's arc, it comes because his wife makes him go to, like, this spa vacation, and he starts realizing that he's getting to the age that his father died at. And meanwhile, he's at a spa where I think like 3 or 4 people are murdered. And he's like, one, I gotta solve this murder. 2, I gotta retire right now.
Because murder just follows him wherever he goes.
He can't escape.
If he's in the business.
Also, his wife has seen like several people be murdered, including one person in which she was in a play. And there's someone, it was Amadeus, and there's a point at which one of the characters is supposed to fake slit, like slitting his own throat, but the knives
was not fake.
Yeah, it was not fake, and she sees this. And then he occasionally goes home and is like, "How are you, Joyce?" And she's like, "I'm okay." And he's like, "All right, great, bye." And I'm like, "No!
Tom, spend a little bit more time with your traumatized wife, who has also witnessed a murder while, like, taking a painting class in a field."
Yep, she witnesses multiple murders.
Probably like one out of every five or so. Yeah. So she's involved in every possible thing you could be involved in that county.
Well,
apparently.
Especially, because she volunteers with everything. So she's always at like the flower festival where someone's going to die. Or of the course. Antique festival where someone's going to die. Or like any play.
The folk festival.
The folk festival where someone's going to die. There's a school. Someone's going to die there too. Like everything is someone's going to die there. And for some reason, Joyce has dragged Tom Barnaby along to go see whatever it is. And then obviously Tom Barnaby has to solve a murder. And then there are points for which Joyce is like, "Do you really have to do this?" And I'm like, "Yeah. Yeah, he does. Because he solves murders. And there's been a murder."
Most important person in Midsummer County. He's the only one keeping it from descending into a purge scenario.
Though, I do love that because there are so many murders in Midsummer, when there is a murder, everyone reacts like, "Oh, fuck. Can we, like, hurry this up a little bit?" I really need this room again, so can you just, like, solve this?
The number one concern of everybody whose, like, establishment has been involved in a murder is, like, when can I reopen this place?
Right.
Like, hey, like, the, like, antique theater, like, really needs its revenue from this week. And it's like, no, like, the body's still on the floor.
Like, we have not yet identified who this person was yet. No, it's the greatest show in the world. And it's so funny also because once you start getting into, like, Midsummer Murders crime drama, like, we also, I started watching Midsummer Murders when my spouse was at Oxford University. Mm-hmm. And which, now having spent some time in Oxford, you're like, oh. Like, it does have a very, like, nothing happens here, but definitely 17 people would have been murdered over a flower festival here. That kind of feel.
Yes.
And then we started watching, like, other British crime dramas. Like, because I'd watched, you know, like, when I was a kid, I watched, like, Poirot and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then you watch other British crime dramas, and they're way, like, Midsummer Murders is very, like, kind of black comedy in a sense.
Oh, yeah. There's definitely an underlying, like they know how absurd
they
this
know
is
that, this, you know, when you're getting murdered with cheese or drowning in beer or, again, wine trebuchet.
Yeah.
Which, the wine trebuchet episode makes the person who's being murdered, like, he's very drunk. Like, he's been, I remember he's drunk, and there's also been something put in whatever he was drinking. And so he literally is guided to, like, an X in the middle of
this
large
he staggers
circle.
To a target that's been placed on his own lawn.
Yeah, and then they're like, "Well, since you're right there, we will use a trebuchet to heave bottles of wine at you," which I'm just like, but you helped. Like, you really helped here.
Yes.
But, no, we started, we watched, like, Inspector Morse, which is great, except that Inspector Morse needs to go talk to a therapist. Like,
most of these detectives, it's
Vera,
like, yo.
Yeah, everybody involved, you're like, you should need to talk to someone, because this is
I was bad. On an Australian murder mysteries kick, because I watched Miss Fisher's,
of
which
course,
is
Miss Fisher's Mysteries is amazing.
And then got to Dr. Blake from that, and Dr. Blake really needs some help.
Yeah. Well, I love Miss Fisher's for many, many reasons. Also because it is implied that they're like, "We gotta solve a murder," and she's like, "I'm gonna help," and they're like, "But why?"
you're not affiliated with the police in any way whatsoever, but you keep popping up.
But you're just this lady detective that rich people like, and by that virtue, you can do whatever it is that you want to do. And you can hire people to help you, and you are basically the constabulary, which I appreciate.
Yeah.
Also that it involved a lengthy one of my favorite things about it is there's an episode of Miss Fisher's in which it's like their Christmas episode, but because of how Australia works, it's Christmas in July.
Mm-hmm.
So they are going to the Southern Alps, which are the mountains, I believe, if this is getting this right, in the south of New Zealand. And my spouse is from New Zealand, so I have been there, which is like where people in New Zealand and Australia go skiing. But it's also just funny because all of this is taking place in July. Like, the entire Christmas episode is,
yes,
like, in which people are getting, again, murdered. I believe in that episode, because it's supposed to be kind of based on like the 12 days of Christmas. Mm-hmm. And I think like 8 or 9 people die. And again, everyone at the end is like, oh, what a wonderful Christmas that was. I'm like, holy shit.
God, what an odd holiday. Like, it's like, no, like,
like you just witnessed a massacre. Yeah, like on American television, you know, I've watched a ton of Law and Order. Like I wrote about Law and Order for The Ringer, actually, because I was talking about how if you watch a lot of Law and Order, you develop this inherent like dislike of defense attorneys, which yes. Now thinking about it, now that I read about criminal justice, I'm like, oh, that was not great.
It was a little insidious.
But like Law and Order, they're like, 2 people died, holy crap, like we gotta fix this right now.
They kept it in the very like, if this happened in New York, this is right. How people would react. Like
exactly, yeah, like, exactly. And even though they're talking about New York, like if you watch early episodes of Law and Order, they're still in kind of the like early Giuliani era, in which like there are a lot of places in episodes of Law and Order they talk about that I'm like, I can't afford to live there or eat brunch there now. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, the meatpacking district. I'm like, yeah, I've been there. It's not that anymore. It is not a place where...
New York has changed.
A lot. And I'm sad that Law and Order no longer exists, because I feel like they could have done a lot of stuff just about, like, sending the late departed Jerry Orbach as Lenny Briscoe to go to, like, Park Slope and be like, what is this place?
What happened?
Because that would happen a lot.
Because I feel like one of the great things about these, like, it's mostly with tech, mm-hmm. but with like the super long running murder mysteries, like first of all, you get put in a time like, right, it's like, oh man, like this would have been very easily solved with the cell phone, but they did not have those.
That is the thing. There's a John Mulaney, the comedian, he has a whole sketch about like how solving murders in like the early 1900s, you'd be like, you know, we're going to draw a chalk outline around this guy so we can see where he was when he died. And you're just like, how did anyone solve any murder?
How was anyone ever caught?
At any point. And like, I'm constantly marveling at the fact that like anyone ever got away with it, like, or anyone ever got caught for anything in like the 1920s.
Yeah, it's weird that like Jack the Ripper or something is like the outlier. It's like,
oh yeah,
you know, like of course you could just walk around killing people. Like,
yeah, I mean,
who was stopping you?
Like, well, because they had just formed like Scotland Yard. There is no such thing as like basic standard practice of detective work. And Jack the Ripper was killing sex workers in London. Like at a certain point,
that's a serial killer strategy that still holds up now.
It still does. And it definitely did then. And there've been a couple of authors who've spent a lot of time trying to figure out like who Jack the Ripper was. And they're like, oh, it was like this Duke or this other person. I'm like, well, we'll literally never know.
Yeah. Like, so... this is beyond needling it. This is needling a haystack from centuries ago.
Right. Right. And it's just as like, I don't know, but it's been funny watching all of these crime dramas, especially Midsummer Murders, because it's such an interesting way of thinking about how to portray crime. Mm-hmm. Also, because some of the episodes of Midsummer Murders, like, you're definitely supposed to kind of, like, get it.
Like, oh, yeah, like, you sympathize with the murderer.
Yeah, you're like...
In, like, a decent number of the episodes, we're just like, man, like, they really got provoked by this horrendous family. Because, like, everybody there is terrible. That's
Thing. Well, that's the other thing. It's like, it is an amazing depiction of English life as just full of just the worst people you could know.
Yes.
And the number of episodes of Midsummer that are, like this, like... I think, like, this terrible person gets murdered, and everyone's like, well, okay.
We're relatively better off.
Yeah, like, it's, like, sure, you have to solve this murder, but, all right.
Like, if you just kind of, like, kick the dude out of the county instead of throw him in jail, like, I don't think anybody would really want to. Really
yeah, I mean, there are multiple times in which whoever Barnaby's second is, because that is a kind of revolving position,
yes.
It's kind of like, it sounds like everyone hates this guy. And Tom or John has to be like, yeah, but, like, we still have to figure out who killed him. Like, you can't kill people. And I'm like, well, it's Midsummer County.
I mean, like, the infamous wine trebuchet episode, all the people who were killed in that episode were, like, the most obnoxious possible people.
Oh, yeah. I was, at a certain point, I was like, we should identify who killed all these people, so we should celebrate.
Yes, because they have knocked off, like, the most obnoxious trivia team in the history of trivia teams.
But it's funny, we were talking before we started recording, I've been rewatching Narcos, and it's funny, like, if you Midsommar Murders is sort of like if you put some of the events of like the first two seasons of Narcos into an imaginary English county, because there are numerous things where it's like, well, he looked at him, so he had to die.
Yeah, there. It doesn't take a lot.
No, no. The instinct towards murder, towards extremely complex murder, yes. Because they can't use guns. So it's always like, oh, like, I need to garrot someone, which I'm like, whoa, that's a lot of effort.
We've gone old school with it. Like, it's true. Impressive.
Yeah, very much so.
But, you know, when you got Barnaby on the case, apparently you got to be super elaborate, because if he had a simple murder to figure out, I assume the show would be 5 minutes long.
It's true, but also the fact that, like, he'll just have moments where he's, like, sitting at dinner and, like, his wife asks him something. He'll be like, that's it. Completely unrelated. I'm like, oh, hey, do you remember that you have this, like, cousin that you never brought up in any of our interviews, but it turns out that this is all because of some long-running feud that happened even before I got here, and that's why you killed everyone. And it's amazing to watch.
It's so good. And I do have, and it's also spawned, like, one of the better accounts on Twitter, which is just the Midsommar Murders bot.
Right.
It just spits out, it's pretty formulaic. It just spits out these fake Midsommar plots, which, if not for the fact that it kind of has the same cadence to each tweet,
yeah,
completely indistinguishable from actual Midsommar Murders plots.
Exactly.
And to prove that, I may have reworded some of these. And
okay.
I'm going to try to see. I've got 10 of them. We're going to see how many of these work. So half of these are from the bot, half of these are real episode descriptions that I have slightly edited down so that it is not
super
incredibly
obvious.
Clear which one is the bot.
All right, okay.
All right, number 10. The local magistrate is drowned inside a lobster trap. Suspicion falls on Midsommar Prior's floral society, angry that charity
is fake.
Drinking
that
games
is fake.
Of pub. Yeah, it is.
It's
fake.
The lobster trap that actually got it, because I was like,
they repeat things.
They do.
Yeah.
And well, also because I was like, hey, wouldn't have lobster in Midsommar.
That is another good one. Okay. When a dead body is discovered covered in live rabbits, Barnaby uncovers
a
sinister
real one.
Side. Dang it!
The rabbit episode, well, also because the rabbit episode, if I remember correctly, also has to do with the giant rabbit festival in which
yes.
everyone is so excited about all their rabbits. And there's like a half an hour interlude interviewing people about how great their rabbits are.
Yeah. Barnaby uncovers a sinister side to the local pet show.
Yes.
In that episode.
Everything in Midsommar has a sinister side. Everything.
So you might do well on this because I ended up picking more of the more recent episodes because
right.
they had shorter episode recaps. Episode summaries. All right. A local homeopath dies in a convertible at the car wash. Barnaby investigates Goodman's Land New Age commune, which is angry that rising flood levels might threaten to delay the rise of the great old ones.
Okay. That is fake, but it would be a great episode. Mm,
it is fake, and I would watch it. Because they've definitely had commune. I mean, that's
they've
the thing.
Had
all
multiple
these,
communes.
All of these start with, like, you know. When Bentham de Ketville falls to his death from a roof after seeing a headless horseman.
Yep, that's a real one.
Yep.
I remember the headless.
God.
Again, it's another episode in which no one liked the person who died, and so everyone just spends the whole time being like, can we just move the body?
His aristocratic family seemed more concerned about their forthcoming Civil War reenactment.
Yep.
All right. The village ne'er-do-well is found shot in the heart at the stroke of midnight, and based on our earlier conversation, you're already going to know this. Barnaby's investigation leads him to Midsommar Parva's amateur drama group, angry that the discovery of a valuable musical manuscript sold cheaply at an auction might threaten a legendary Anglo-Saxon treasure hoard.
Oh my god. Okay, I don't think that one's real.
It's not real.
Okay.
Probably, I'm assuming you got it because shot in the heart is...
Well,
because
there have been like...
You've named the two gun deaths.
It's true. But then for a second I was like, oh, that does sound like something that would happen on Midsommar.
Mm-hmm. And once you pack in like 20 seasons, eventually it becomes tough to remember all of them.
Which I really would love to be like to interview the writer's room for Midsommar Murders, because at this point, like, how do you beat the Midsommar Murders plot bot? Like, how are you just like they're gonna have to start. I don't even know where they.
I think they're gonna just have to start stealing them from it.
Oh yeah,
just roll with it.
Yeah,
they're handing them right to you.
Exactly.
All right, you are 5 for 5 so far.
Oh, excellent.
Mysterious lights are seen in the sky over famous UFO hotspot Cooper Hill. When a local forest ranger suffers a strange death.
I remember that.
The visiting
UFO stops. There's slime involved. It's super weird.
They're convinced aliens are responsible. It's wonderful. when Midsummer Mallow is a contender to win the perfect English village competition. Not everything is perfect.
That's real.
Yep. After robbing a retired actor's mansion of valuable goods, the local thief is stabbed with a pitchfork. And also the villagers try to keep the murder quiet because it would lessen their chances of winning the best village competition.
Yep. Yep. Again. Yeah, this all checks out.
Yeah. All right. Only three left to see if I could trip you up with any of these.
Okay.
The master of the local Freemason's Lodge is found beaten to death with an oak staff. Suspicion falls on Midsummer Wyvern's classic and modified car club, angry that guerrilla tactics by activists might threaten to make history repeat itself. When a nun is strangled to death, Barnaby investigates the cloistered world of Midsummer Priory. He uncovers a complex mystery involving holy orders, teenage romantic liaisons, African art, and a missing antique silver.
As the community
is forced to open its doors to 21st century policing. Series 14, episode 7. Finally, an unexpected visitor is found cut into pieces with a 14th century samurai sword. Barnaby suspects Midsummer Virtue's tea leaf reader, who's angry that rising flood levels might threaten the local co-op.
That's fake.
Yeah. The wording of the bot one, I should have spent more time rewording it.
It's okay. Generally, the angry is a giveaway, but also I was like, I would have remembered a sword. The samurai sword one I'd remember. Because all of these, like, you're generally, when you see the murder, you're, like, in the position of, like, the viewer of seeing the murder happen.
Yeah.
And I think I would have remembered a samurai sword.
Yeah, if you're the murderer and you're like, you've got the sword. Because that would have been one of the bloodier deaths on that show. Because they've like thrown people off the top of buildings, but usually they don't just like cut people open.
No. It's not a very gory show for the fact that it is strongly reliant on many murders.
Very prolific with the death count. But
exactly.
Low blood to death ratio on that show.
That's true. Yeah. There's actually a website that tracks every death in every episode. And there are some episodes in which as many as like 8 or 9 people die. And it just is... Oh, what a great show.
Yeah, I'm honestly surprised that, like, that's the lower, that's the higher end of the scale for them.
Yeah. Because
it feels like some episodes is just a constant parade of death.
Exactly.
The other thing that we absolutely have to talk about is the two competing documentaries on Netflix and Hulu on...
The single greatest thing that's ever happened, or actually technically didn't happen.
Yeah, the greatest party that never happened. I believe that's the title of the Netflix doc.
Netflix one.
Hulu went with Fire Fraud, I think.
Which I think was a stronger... Because, I mean, the difference, and we were talking about this, is that the Netflix Fire Festival documentary... was made by the advertising company that was working on Fire Festival. So the entire underlying message of the Netflix documentary is basically like, this could have worked. It didn't, but it could have.
And you watch the Hulu one and it's like, absolutely no point. I mean, he's firing entire staffs of people because they're telling him, like, dude, are you kidding me? You gave us 4 months to do something that you need 18 to do.
And even the people who are just like, okay, maybe this might work. They are also saying this isn't going to work, and he's trying to get rid of them.
Yeah, the dudes on the island who are, like, setting things up for him. The guy who taught himself how to fly using a flight simulator.
Yes, that guy who, if the guy who has learned
sage wisdom from that guy.
If the guy who taught himself how to fly on, like, Microsoft Flight Simulator is telling you you can't do something, you should listen to him.
But yeah, because he has stretched the bounds of, like, things you should think are plausible.
Exactly, but I think we should back up just a touch.
Yes.
So, the Fire Festival was supposed to be a music festival that was going to take place in the Exumas in the Bahamas.
Yes.
And the person behind this was a person named Billy McFarland, the greatest grifter of our time. And I know that we're kind of like an era of grifters, Summer of Grifters, Anna Delvey, everybody. But
Theranos.
I
just ordered the book. I'm so excited.
The fact that she changed her voice to do this... we can get into that another time. But so he had... It's interesting because if you watch the Netflix documentary, they don't go as much into this, but in the Hulu one, they talk about how he had always been, in his view, a quote-unquote entrepreneur, but even the stories from his childhood are just of him being a giant scammer.
Yes.
Like, he tells this story excitedly about how he used to have other kids pay him to put their crayons back together, and he was like, yeah. And
a dollar a crayon!
A dollar a crayon, which is a god dang, like, that is a scam.
That's a racket.
Like,
and also, he hacked into the school's little, like,
yeah,
whatever, like, keyboards thing they had so that it would just say to go find him, and, you know,
yeah,
it was advertising his business by hacking into the school's computer.
Right, exactly, which his parents, for some ungodly reason, appear in this Hulu documentary. Because in the Hulu documentary, he was paid to appear in the Hulu documentary,
yeah,
but apparently had not quite considered the fact that the Hulu documentary would mean that he'd be asked a lot of questions about this
on camera.
A lot of questions, and it doesn't go well. But so his parents and him are telling all these stories about, like, oh, he was just this little entrepreneur, in which you're like, oh my god, he's been a scammer this whole time.
Yeah, all this is supposed to come off as like, this is cute, and it's like, no, you raised a little sociopath.
Exactly. So we get to like 2000, and Hulu does a really good job of kind of putting this in, like, a good context of, like, millennials and dealing with the financial crisis of, like, 2007, 2008.
Because they dig it back. Like, the Netflix one, like, mentions, like, Magnesis, which we'll get into.
Yeah.
Or Magnesis. He spells it wrong.
Right.
But the Hulu one brings up Spling, which Netflix does not, which is just, like, this dude, like, his, like, big idea coming out of college was a worse version of Google Plus, and then the demo totally bombed.
Yeah, and the
and
demo...
And this is like this visionary genius.
Yeah, and the Hulu, they show his demo for this business, for this like Google Plus-like thing, and it's incredibly uncomfortable to watch. And,
which, in this, given these documentaries, is really saying something.
Yeah, it really is. But then he comes up with, and as far as I can tell, and I know we've discussed this, and I've discussed this with other people, his big solution to, like, the money crises suffered by millennials who mm-hmm. have just endured, like, the financial crisis and the Great Recession is that what millennials want is a metal credit card.
Yes, but what we want is a black card that doesn't actually have...
Right, because he figured out how to print his credit card number on, like... Because they show this interview that he had given around the time in which he had printed his credit card information on, like, a metal sheet of something, and then like went downstairs and paid for something with it. And he's like, this is a great idea. And I'm like, I don't understand why this is a great idea. But also because he's, oh, but, you know, once you become a member, you also get access to this, like, clubhouse?
Yeah, that they eventually get evicted from because they're, like, trashing the place.
Yes,
but, like,
and
it's I think someone mentions that, like, in the Hulu documentary, they're like, you know, it wasn't exactly the people that, like, they were advertising
right.
would be there would be like you're expecting like, you know, like kind of that Instagram influencer
right no but you're getting like jerk kid, like the bridge and tunnel jerks.
Yeah,
like,
I think I can't remember which person in the Hulu documentary described them as people who would join a frat after college if they could.
Right, exactly. And someone reached out to me on Twitter and was like, yeah, I used to live in the building where the clubhouse was.
Oh, man.
And they were like, yeah, it wasn't great because that's who was trying to come.
Yeah, I would not want to be in that building.
And then he gets this other idea, and it is for an app. And the entire reason for the Fyre Festival was supposed to be advertising for this app. And the app, the basic concept of the app, no one can explain to me why anyone would pay money to do this, which is pretty much, it's an app that would have a giant kind of listing of famous people that you could hypothetically pay to appear at things.
Yeah.
Like your birthday or a party or something.
It's like Tinder for celebrity appearances.
Right. Which I don't get what the selling point of that is.
It's like they've got booking agents. I presume they put up that level of, like, that wall so that they aren't that easy to find. Like,
exactly. That's part of the point.
Yeah. I need to know what celebrities were actually buying into this other than Ja Rule.
Ja Rule. So, okay. So we get to this point, and already, like, the Magnesis thing, like, the credit card has... People are starting to realize, like, oh, this is a giant Ponzi scheme.
Yes.
But, like, the app, because he's got Ja Rule on board by just the app. And that's when they...
Because Ja Rule was on board with the Magnesa stuff, too, because he gives that incredible quote to Fox News.
Yes.
That I'm not going to read right now because it's on my top 10 most ridiculous things from
these documentaries. But it's amazing. And even, you know, when you stun people on Fox Business, you've really done something.
You really
have. But Ja Rule gets involved, which is how you know this is all going to work out great.
Yes.
And they decide that the best way to advertise this app, essentially, is to put on a giant music festival. And the thing about both documentaries is that they really get across the fact that, like, technically the Fyre Festival did happen. It just was, it was the time in which they flew a bunch of supermodels down to the Bahamas and sent Ja Rule and Billy McFarlane and all the, like, camera people down to film them. And then basically use that for advertising for this festival to kind of imply that if you went to this festival, you too could get on like a jet ski with Kendall Jenner or something like
that. Yeah, or like hang out and pet pigs. With,
right, exactly. Now, the thing about it is like if anyone has been to a music festival, you're well aware that like, you know, if you're sending 10,000 people somewhere, all 10,000 people cannot do this clearly like very intimate thing.
Yes.
But that was what the entire festival kind of was
sold itself as.
And, you know...
Influencers may not be, like, the brightest among
us.
Because also the prices...
The prices
were so obscene.
Like, and there are a lot of really obvious moments in which you start, like... You know, when you're watching these documentaries, it's basically, like... You know, when you're watching, like, a kind of a not great horror movie, and there's the moment, like, let's all split up, and you're like, shouldn't do that. And then there's, like, oh, there's this terrifying barn, let's go inside, shouldn't do that. And there are many moments in these documentaries, like when festival goers were told, like, oh, you won't be able to use money here, so you should just load as much money as you can onto these bracelets.
Like,
you
know, we recommend $3,000.
Yeah, we recommend, like, just put, because they were running out of money to actually pay for things.
Sort of amazing how they kept the ball rolling as long as they did.
The fact that people actually showed up, especially because, like, all of the, like, they interview, I think it's for the Hulu one, or I can't remember which one, but, like, they interview, like, Major Lazer and, like, some of the artists that they had said.
That was the Netflix one.
That's the Netflix one, who they had said would be there. And they, you know, someone gets in touch with those people, like, they had, you know, Billy McFarlane had all these, like, information sheets about, which is how he was trying to get money from investors. And every investor he apparently talked to was, like, the worst people in the world.
Yes.
Like, he talked to an investor who later, like, died in a strange car accident.
That may be on the list.
Yeah. That was weird. But,
yeah.
Like, the entire thing is just, like, you know, he had advertised, like, oh, I paid all of these artists, like, way more money than they were due. And then someone would get in touch with the artist, like, have you been paid yet? No. But it just keeps going. And you see in this footage of, like, McFarlane and Ja Rule, and Ja Rule is just being Ja Rule. Like,
yeah.
He's
hammered the whole time. So Billy McFarlane also seems to be hammered the whole time, he's, like, a high-functioning alcoholic.
He's a high-functioning alcoholic. It's interesting that when they interview Billy McFarlane in the Hulu documentary, he has clearly gone on the, like, I'm a better person now diet, because he is dramatically less... swollen?
The puff that comes from alcohol and maybe, you know, things
other
you put
things
up your nose.
Exactly. And
it's not there anymore.
Right. And so he's, like, doing this whole interview and his interpretation of events. I think my favorite part of his interview is, like, name one thing I've lied about. Name one thing. And then the Hulu documentary
is like,
oh.
Montage.
There's a montage of things. Because he said that he had raised all of this money and he talked about, like, he lied about how much Facebook stock he had. And then this all leads to...
the number of Magnesis customers.
Oh,
I'm going to say it a different way every time.
Exactly. I mean, there. I refuse to learn the correct way because there is none.
Because they spelled it wrong.
But I think it all comes down to the moment in which the people show up who are attending this festival. And it has poured rain the night before. And they are... you know, they were supposed to be flown in on private jets, and yet they all get on, like, passenger planes, and are like, oh, okay. And what they see are just row after row after row of, like, hurricane tents.
Straight up FEMA tents.
FEMA tents.
And the mattresses aren't even in them yet.
Nope, and they're all soaking wet. And no one is in charge, and anyone who tries to get in charge, like, there's a moment which Billy McFarlane himself gets on a table, and it's just like, okay, like, go get yourself a tent or
something. Which immediately turns it into, like, a Hunger Games
scenario. Oh, yeah. I mean, as it obviously would, because the only thing that they paid any money on is they paid $2.2 million on alcohol. And my one of my favorite things in this in the Hulu documentary is that the guy in the Bahamas was like, that's the stupidest thing you can do because the import tax on alcohol in the Bahamas is 40%.
45%.
It is not a good idea to import alcohol in the Bahamas. And, I mean, they have lots of issues with importing things into places.
Yes, that very much comes up in the Netflix documentary. My goodness.
Oh, man. It's just like...
Poor Andy King.
It's both of these documentaries. For one thing, the idea of, like, social media influencers and the fact that, like, this would be something that... It was so pitched at them that I think that that really is part... In part why, like, so many people were so entertained by everything. I mean, granted, it's incredibly entertaining.
Oh, my goodness.
I've watched both documentaries and will likely watch them both again. But it was very much aimed at not, like, us to go to this thing. Like,
I'm not the target audience. I have no misconceptions about my ability to afford this experience or even have this experience in the first place because I know that, like, I am not going to get into a conversation with a supermodel at a music festival.
Clearly not.
It's just not how it works.
No. And, but, like... It was so expensive. And they interview people who went in both of these documentaries, and you're just like, you should have probably guessed this wasn't going to go quite the way you thought it would. But I think it was one of those experiences, like, if this would have happened at, like, Bonnaroo, I think there would have been a lot less, like, entertainment in that, because that is something that's like, okay, it's a thing that people might want to go do. Like,
yeah, people spending, like, $200 to go and, like, bring in a tent with them as opposed to, you know, $20,000 for a villa that doesn't exist.
Right, or apparently for one person exists because...
Which still wasn't explained.
No, it was not explained, and I have more questions about that. But, do you have a top 10 about...
I have a top 10. I'm still, like... We have mentioned several things, actually, on the honorable mentions already, which is the $2 million worth of booze with the 45% alcohol tax, the act of God storm the night before the festival that caused, like, all of the workers who are, at that point... Legitimately traumatized. It seems like that really comes across, especially in the Netflix documentary, just like how much this destroyed the people who were working on it for like the weeks leading up to the festival.
And then they rightly wanted to go after the organizers, which is why one of the organizers winds up like lying down in the back of a car to try to get out of this area. Mm-hmm. And like it just... I was very comforted to know that the woman who owns that restaurant, she set up a GoFundMe and has like remade all of her money.
Yes.
Because I think you watch that and you're like, I would like to give this woman money because of what these maniacs did to her.
Yes. Let's see. The group of Instagram influencers being locked in the airport in the Bahamas with no food or water when they're trying to escape the island.
Exactly. Also worth mentioning, again, all they have had is alcohol. So
all day.
Tequila.
These people did not plan out. Like they got to this place, saw that there were no like proper facilities for anything. They're waiting for 2 hours in line. Yeah. There's nothing else set up, and like they're just pouring bottles of liquor down their throats.
Yep, literally pouring them. Like they're doing, and like they're drinking tequila. And I'm just imagining like being locked in an airport in a hot place while having consumed only tequila. That's what hell is.
Yeah, I mean like. I could take like a 2 hour flight somewhere and I'm just enough of like travel disoriented. We're like, I need like a couple hours before I'm going to pick up a drink.
Right. No.
And these people just got bust past FEMA tents and they're like, well, let's party. Like, why not? We're just going to do it.
Especially because when they first get to the place, like they start out at like an actual building in which it's basically like, okay, you just party here. And then they would ask, like, the Bahamian people, like, where are we supposed to go? And they're like, we have no idea.
Yeah.
Like, there are so many moments in which I would, you know, you would land and then just be like, I just want to get back on the plane. Like, just get back on the plane. And then they tried to get on the plane and then they get kicked off the plane.
Yes, because the count's wrong.
Oh, it just sounded awful.
Yeah, like, it was really... It was the only way to get me to feel sorry for, like, that Austin Mills dude.
Oh, yeah.
It was just like, man, this is, like, the blankest slate of a human being I've ever seen, and yet somehow I'm feeling empathy
for this man.
Because he has been jerked around in what has been, like, a terrible 24 hours by most anybody's standards.
Pretty much, yeah. I won't even get into the fact that he paid for that, but, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It's... Okay.
Set that aside. Okay.
The last honorable mention is that they considered robbing customs.
Yes.
Just straight up robbing customs.
Right. Which, don't do that.
It's a real bad idea.
It is.
Okay. Number 10 on my list is related to... So after Billy McFarlane, like, basically tells them to go Hunger Games and just find tents. In the Hulu documentary, they don't really show this. Yeah. The Netflix one, they really capture like the chaos of it.
And people the people who like slash other people's tents.
That's the one, because there's like this one influencer who's like, first of all, he's talking about how they're peeing on mattresses so that other people can't get to them.
Yeah.
And then you see him like, and then they cut to footage of him like from that night, and he's like, secure the perimeter. Like, this has become a military operation. They're like, we don't want to be on the interior. Like, get to the outside.
Which I remember when we watched this for the first time, my spouse was like, do you think that like someone could pursue legal action against that guy? Because that dude just destroyed like a bunch of stuff.
I would not have admitted that on camera.
No.
Especially not so, like, that guy made it seem like that was a totally reasonable thing to do in that situation. It's like, what? Like, why are you depriving other people of mattresses? Like, they're already soaking wet. Like, this is already gross. Like,
yeah. No, it's already bad. And it just...
Nobody
just
was sleeping anyway.
No,
just don't make him sleep on the floor.
Ugh.
Okay, number 8 is just that there's a dude named McDavid.
Yeah.
I just need to get that out there. He's involved in the Fyre Festival. No apostrophe.
Yeah.
Capital D.
Yep.
David.
Yep. I mean, by the time you get through both documentaries, that just seems quaint.
Yeah, it really does. Just like, you don't even really, it doesn't register. It didn't register to me because he's like, he's one of the talking heads in the Netflix one. But in the Hulu one, like, you see him mentioned in like the bottom line when they're like showing their like talks at whatever conferences.
Yeah.
And like his name pops up there and like it did not register because I watched the Hulu one first.
Right.
It did not register until I saw Spencer Hall tweet, like, there is a dude named McDavid.
Yep.
I was like, oh, there really is. I saw that. That was not something that I hallucinated. It was not a typo.
Nope.
He just stuck an M in front of David.
Yep, that he did. That's what he did.
Okay. Number 8 is Andy King, who will come up again later, who is like the... kind of like the events guy, sort of like the guy who has experience in putting together big events. He's kind of stuck with like coordinating a lot of the logistics.
Yeah.
And he really believes in Billy McFarland.
Oh, God.
This poor guy really believes in Billy McFarland.
And that's the thing that gets me about this and like other grifter stories is that a grifter can only grift if there's someone to be grifted. And the idea that you would look at someone like Billy McFarland and be like, yes.
Who is talking at cocaine speed?
He's talking at cocaine speed. He has that perpetual cocaine optimism of like, this is definitely going to work. We've already figured everything out. There are no problems. If you tell me about problems, I'll just ignore you.
Yeah.
Or like try to get rid of
you. We are going to just bulldoze through this with optimism.
Oh, no.
And you could see, man, it especially came through in the Netflix one where the workers were just like, we can't talk to him anymore. Like, it's like talking to a wall. But yeah, anyway, Andy King having to smuggle himself off the island after trading clothes with another worker.
Yep.
Hiding behind a urinal.
Yep.
And eventually getting his way to an airplane. That story, by the end of the Netflix documentary, barely registers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that's ludicrous.
No,
like, this is like a very, like... put together, like, dapper dude who's, like...
also,
who's apparently crouched down behind a urinal.
Also, he's much older than a lot of the other people involved.
Everybody else involved
like,
in this.
Would be
except,
like
one venture capitalist.
Yeah, he'd be,
maybe.
Like, 15 to 20 years older than everyone, and yet he's like, I gotta get out of here.
Yeah. And when that dude's like, I'm apparently hitting the, like, get out and bail thing, like...
yeah.
I bet everybody else was on that, too. Okay, number 7 for me is that despite doing nothing overtly wrong, the social media expert in the Hulu documentary is one of the 4 worst people involved in this entire thing.
Yep. Yep.
Like, just the way she talks about it, the way she describes influencer culture, the way she describes, like, Kendall Jenner as, like, a transformative human being
who's
changing
the
world. It's just, like, she almost represented more of what was awful about, like... Because, like, Hulu kind of tried to make this about, like, millennial culture. And it was like, well, yeah, to an extent, but, like, this is, like... a very specific subset of millennials.
Which, I mean, that reminds me that part of this is that this was supposed to take place in the beach that was, according to the Fyre Festival organizers, owned at one point by Pablo Escobar.
Yes.
Now, whether or not that point is true is up for debate, because it may have been, like, there was another trafficker who, if anyone has seen the movie Blow, George Jung, like, worked with this trafficker, and it may have also involved Pablo Escobar, but also... was it the Hulu documentary that then the social media manager was getting contacted by, like, people who Pablo Escobar, like, family members of people Pablo Escobar killed, and being like, why are you advertising yourself?
Is this like the very first thing that they're told after they like decide to have it on this island is like, do not attach Pablo Escobar's name to this. And the very first thing they do is put it in advertising.
And then like they're like, you know that Pablo Escobar was like a brutal murderer who shot and killed a lot of people himself and had other people killed in really horrifying ways and blew up a plane.
Yep.
Like, maybe not the guy to be like, yeah, that sounds great for, like, influencers.
Did you sit down and watch the two Escobars, man? Like, come on. Yeah, that's another great documentary for another time.
30 for 30. Very depressing.
Yeah, yeah. You gotta really steel yourself to watch that. Okay. Number six, Grant, who's kind of the, I don't even know what his job role is, but he's sort of the number two to Billy McFarland to this. Is the most obnoxious dude ever.
Right.
Is clearly dipping into the same stuff that Billy's dipping into whenever they show him talking. It's right. Like, just please stop this fire hose. And they reveal at the very end of, I think, the Hulu documentary that he is now an EMT.
Yes. Yes. Which, I hope he is better at that. Because he said...
Or there are dead people out there. Yeah. There are bodies.
He was... In both documentaries, I loved how people were just like, oh... Grant, like, we just, no one really liked him. He was not
And this is a documentary where like a bunch of people are still like kind of on Billy's side,
right?
Like, who are like not that against a dude who is like clearly a sociopath,
right? Exactly.
And everybody's like, man, Grant was the worst.
Yeah, people are still accepting calls from Billy McFarland, but Grant, no, absolutely not.
Unbelievable. Yeah, Grant probably did not like bounce back with a model girlfriend. I don't think. Which is yet another completely insane thing that did not make my list.
Yeah,
Billy McFarland's model girlfriend.
Billy McFarland's model girlfriend who Googles him and was like, oh, but he was so nice and we had such a good time together. And then at the end of the Hulu documentary, he calls her from prison. And she's like, hey, babe. And I'm like, no!
And she also, before that, there's this moment where she starts talking and she just has to stop. She's like, I'm shaking.
Yes.
And it's like, yeah, like, you're shaking because the truth has almost hit you and you are in such deep denial that you are just going to keep powering through it even though your body is telling you to get out because it can't physically handle being in a relationship with this scammer.
Oh, man.
And she's going to wait for him 6 years? That's the other part of this, is like, this dude just went to prison.
Yeah.
On like a six-year sentence.
Just did. Like, this happened while they were filming the Hulu documentary.
And it's going to be hard to let that guy out early on good behavior.
Yeah. Because especially in New York. Yeah. Like, that's going to go poorly.
So, oh my God. Just, like, I don't even feel bad about doing this list because I have left out so many things that we have not spoiled anything about watching the Fyre Festival documentaries.
Nope.
Speaking of which, this is an exact quote from Ja Rule on Fox Business talking about a fake credit card company. It's a very unique situation. Whenever you can marry the affluent with the less fortunate, you get the birth child, which is called hip-hop.
My favorite moment is the woman who is interviewing him responds with, but it's a credit card. And no one... I also love that Ja Rule clearly has gone with the, like, if I just dress a certain way, people will treat me in a certain way and assume that I know what I'm talking about. So for this interview, I believe he's wearing, like, a vest and, like, glasses.
He is rocking some stuff that, like, you'd expect somebody on the Fox Business Channel to wear.
Yeah, but it's just, it's not.
He's not pulling it off when he says that.
No, absolutely not. And it's, I think one of my favorite things also is the perception of Ja Rule in both of these documentaries, which has led Ja Rule recently to start tweeting about how, like, he wasn't a part of this, like, he didn't hoodwink anyone, and I'm like, you did.
Like, dude, you're on tape, man. Like, is this the other thing? They videotaped all of this.
Oh, yeah. Like, when he goes
you
on
really
that...
You documented the scam.
When he goes on the podcast that apparently is just, you just get shit-faced on a podcast, which I'm like, that's a great podcast idea.
Awesome.
But a lot of people will admit to things, including, like, yeah, this was all my idea.
Ja Rule probably didn't consult with his lawyer before making that appearance.
I feel like Ja Rule didn't consult with his lawyer on a lot of things. If you're Ja Rule's lawyer, you're just the most put-upon person in America.
Deeply depressed right now.
Oh, yeah.
For very, very good reasons.
Exactly.
All right. Speaking of which, I actually have Billy documents his own fraud, which he commits while he's out on bail for the Fyre Festival fraud. He does his this like fake ticket scam where he's selling tickets to
things that you can't get tickets to,
like the Met Gala,
Met Gala, like the Victoria's Secret fashion show, and he's like he's sending, I think my favorite part of that is that he is sending this all to the exact same email list as for Fyre Festival attendees. So you've like just gotten home from that shit show. And then someone with like a weird name is emailing you about like whether or not you want tickets to the Met Gala.
Yeah, and it's some dude on the phone named Freddie who's just hanging in an apartment, like a ridiculously nice apartment with Billy McFarland.
And Chuck Schumer's top
and
agent.
Yeah, who like... And then he's got a camera crew that he brings in. And Chuck Schumer's top aide apparently was not informed of this because takes one look at the camera and is like, oh my God.
Which I just...
We see him once and he is mortified.
We see him once and he's like, nope, gotta go. And then like later he tried to be like, well, you know, we've just been friends for a long time. And I'm like, see, that's not what you go with here.
Yeah, that's not helping the whole character. Like, it was better if, like, I had no idea who this guy was.
Nope, he
bribed me to show up to this apartment.
Exactly.
I had no idea what was happening, and then I left.
Yes, that's the better story than we've been friends for a long time. Because that introduces more questions.
It's not good.
No.
And, like, and also just, like, I mean, someone mentions, like, you know, when you're out on bail, that's really the time where you want to do the least number of crimes.
Well, he asks someone... who was working with him on the second scam, like, who had been to prison. And he's trying to explain the 23-in-1, which is that you spend 23 hours a day in your cell, and then 1 hour, like, trying to get exercise.
And that's the first, like, 2 weeks or whatever until they place you.
Yeah, that's terrible.
Yeah.
And then he's telling this to Billy McFarland, and Billy McFarland is like, oh, well, like, that's not going to happen to
it's
me.
Like, dude, you are out on bail. Like,
do you know what being... Oh, man.
So, speaking of giant frauds,
yes,
you mentioned this briefly earlier, but this has an insane NBA tie-in because one of the big investors in Magnesis is Aubrey McClendon, who's like this oil and energy baron in Oklahoma. He is one of the owners of the Oklahoma City Thunder, which is not a major point in someone's character because they bought the team and immediately ripped them away from Seattle after telling them that they were not going to do that.
Right.
Howard Schultz is finding out that people did not necessarily
forget that.
People are
still mad about
that.
Yeah. People are still mad. That
is the only time we will dive into anything related to politics in this podcast.
Yeah.
So Aubrey McClendon is like by far the biggest fish that Billy McFarland has hooked.
Yes. And they have this amazing, according to Billy McFarland. Now, everything that Billy McFarland says, I assume, is probably not true. But
almost
that's what he said.
Yes.
Is that like they had this terrific meeting and he had put like a bunch of money into Magnesis. And then what happens?
And then Aubrey McClendon gets caught up in a big old fraud of his own involving the SEC and whatnot. And and once that all comes down, he dies in a one-car crash that is very clearly a suicide.
Yep, it's fiery. A fiery one-car crash. And I think the reaction that was most telling is Billy McFarland's reaction to that is like he was like, well, I just told myself that that wasn't true for about a week, so I just didn't believe it. And I'm like, oh.
That's how you handle this. That's how you work. That fits.
Yep.
that definitely checks out. That was the one part where I was just like, no, you're not lying on that one.
Nope.
Like, that one I believe.
Yep, exactly.
One that was a little less believable, my number two, and God, this would be number one in almost any other situation, is that Billy McFarland, to a camera, claimed that the reason that they did not put people in villas is because they had a giant box of keys to like $200 million worth of houses and cars to get the people there, and they just lost the box of keys.
Mm-hmm. And that
a very plausible story.
And he goes with that. He goes with this story of the box of keys, and like he is looking at the camera, and it just like, this is what happened. And you could like, and they're just like, I'm sorry, what? What?
The amount of dead air that you hear sometimes after his answers, where like he's expecting the interviewer to just roll along with it and they just let him sit there and stew in it. It's wonderful.
Well, there's a point in the Hulu documentary in which he's like, I just need a 10-minute personal break. And they're like, why? He's like, I just need that. Because I'm like, even for him, keeping this up is really difficult.
Yeah, he's having a hard time because there are some of the like some of his answers like he almost like stops partway through because like he's coming up with it on the spot
or
and it's not really
to,
checking out.
Or just trying to think of like, okay, what did my lawyer tell me or something? Because again, if we've learned anything over the last couple of years, it's there's a attorney, Ken White, he's at Pope Hat on Twitter, And his advice is always shut the fuck up and wait for your lawyer.
Yes.
In general,
it's great advice.
Shut the fuck up and wait for your lawyer does not imply accept money to appear in a documentary and answer a bunch of questions.
Especially since, like, at first I was like, man, like, it's, you know, it's a little funky that Hulu is giving this guy money. And then it's like, oh, man, he's never going to see that money. That dude owes, like, $27 million based on, from that judgment or whatever. Like, one's ever seeing all of that money,
no.
The people who asked for it.
Especially the,
like,
moment you start getting down with, like, the Securities and Exchange Commission, they're going to, like, that's...
They know you got paid to appear in this documentary.
Yeah, they know that. They know everything about that. It's interesting. Once you start getting into, like, white-collar crime... There are things people know, and they're just like, you can go ahead and do that. You're still going to pay us our money at some point, in some way, whatever way you find possible.
I really want to know how long that check was in Billy McFarlane's possession.
I wonder if they had to write it for him, like, while he was there, or whether it was like, I want to,
like,
see...
do we just wire this money directly to the attorney's office in New York?
I want to see that email thread. I really, because I imagine he just kept saying, like, oh, I'd love to do this, but, you know, I'm being advised that, and then...
I wonder if they had to, like, slowly bump that number up until finally, like, that dude was finally like, I love money too much to
this. Because, I mean, this all is about someone who deeply loves money, perhaps more than other things, and is willing to, you know, it's kind of romantic how he's willing to do anything for love.
He's really pushed through a lot.
He really has.
Yeah.
And your number one moment.
Oh,
which
my God.
I think we both know what it is.
Yeah, so, I mean, the Netflix documentary features... the customs story, where, like, so poor damn Andy King, the events guy, is gay.
Yes.
And apparently Billy McFarlane is acutely aware of this.
But acutely aware in a very specific way.
In that, like, they're having trouble, you know, with customs because they haven't paid for anything.
And they need to get water.
They have a shipment of not just water, but Evian water, because of course they do that.
Oh, God. Yeah, of course they would.
And... it's being held at customs because they're not paying for it.
Right.
Billy McFarlane calls Andy King and asks him to perform a very involved sexual favor.
Yes.
To get this water out of customs.
And Andy King's response is to go home, take a shower, use some mouthwash.
The mouthwash.
And then just be like, okay. And that's, let me parse this out. There is no business associate on the face of the earth who, in normal parlance, will ask you to perform a sex act as general course of business events. And for this poor guy, who now has become a meme about, like...
He's now become so many memes.
I know. And then I think my favorite new one is he said he was interviewed later and he was like, well, you know, I didn't really want to become a meme. And so
this is the second half of this is that he was shocked that he became, like, the quote-unquote blowjob king. And he, like, gives this interview to Netflix.
And then someone tweeted just above a picture, like, so how bad do you want this to go away? And I'm like, oh, Andy!
Oh, no, like, oh, he's just never going to live it down.
No!
And of course, that tweet is like 100,000 faves or whatever.
Oh,
it's,
no,
I mean... I laughed very hard when I saw
it. It's amazing. But it's just also, like... he just has this expression throughout the documentary of just being like, I'm trying to explain how I made the stupidest series of decisions possible. Like...
and he's like... and he's also like... he's one of the most likable people by far. In either of these documentaries.
Oh,
and, like, he also, like, he's used this and turned it into, like, a platform to GoFundMe and raise money for the workers in the Bahamas who were stiff. Which is
that's great.
Like, you have used this for very good things.
Right.
But if you're hoping to be known for anything but that for the rest of your life, I have really bad news.
Yeah, I mean, he's the only one also who seems to come into this with, like, full, actual honesty. Because if you watch the Netflix one... you need to know, like, everyone who is generally being interviewed for that, like, the main people, they are all working for the company that produced the Netflix documentary, which is very much, again, supposed to cross the point that, like, if Billy McFarlane wouldn't have been such a fuck-up, this all would have worked out great.
And they also don't include any details about, like, the Jerry Media Company in general, which, like, got to where they were basically by stealing other people's content, posting it as their own. And
which
now they actually just lost their contract with Comedy Central, which is great because they thought that, like... producing this documentary and getting out ahead of it would really help them, like, you know, save this company, make it look good. And now it's just like, oh no, you're just gonna lose everything.
Right. Well, they
and we saw their. Did you see the world like the world record egg idea that they came up with?
Yeah, but their whole thing also was like, yeah, it's gonna also be an egg that somehow calls for Trump's resignation.
And they want and they asked a nonprofit for like $20 million to enact this idea. It's like, oh, so this is what happens when you don't get to steal other people's ideas and you have to come up with them on your own.
It's so bad. It's so bad. But like both of these documentaries were so interesting because it's like. I will say that I don't know how Billy McFarlane was able to persuade this many people of things, but when you see the rooms of people, like the people who are working on the app, which had nothing to do with the festival, who are like this
that
room,
was like moving along as a legitimate business operation. I mean, it might have been a crappy app or whatever, but like it was an app
and
that
they
were doing.
And then they get on a call with Billy McFarlane and he's, and they're like, should we be worried about the FBI? And he's like, I don't know.
See, he says that's it's an individual thing.
Oh, God. And you're just
like, dude.
And there, I'm just looking at this dude and just thinking, like, how? But then, like, I think that there is really something to be said about, you know, there is an argument, you know, I think it was in a piece about Anna Delvey, who's like this grifter in New York.
Yes.
Great New York magazine piece. And I think the title is something like, maybe she had so much money she just lost track of it. Because she was kind of grifting, like, very wealthy kind of millennial New Yorkers who all have jobs that don't seem like jobs.
Yeah, just by, playing the part.
Right, just playing the part and then doing, like, she would just be like, oh, you know, we should all take this private jet. Oh, can you put it on your credit card? And people would say things like, well, maybe she just kind of forgot how much money she has. It's fine. Don't worry about it. But, like, in a certain sense, there's the grifter and then there are kind of people who are kind of, like, wanting to be grifted in a sense. Like, if you're looking at Billy McFarlane and he's telling you about, like, this metal credit card and an app to get talent to your birthday party and how this festival is going to convince all these people, like thousands of people are going to spend thousands of dollars for a thing that he has barely planned and that they had like a 6-month run up. No. And you're like, yeah, let's do that. I'm like, at a certain point, you should have been asking a lot of questions a long time ago.
Yeah. I mean, for so many people, like you see that Austin Mills influencer dude in the airport. And like, he's like, this is either going to be like the best thing or the worst thing ever. And it's like, dude, clearly the latter. And like someone's like, oh, Blink-182 just canceled while we're waiting at the airport.
Like, why
still going to get on the plane?
Yeah, and it's also, I'm like, if Blink-182 knows better, then maybe, like, well, also that this is also reliant on like Ja Rule and Blink-182, which I'm just like, man, like, is it 2002?
Yeah, and like it's got to be, it's a real bad sign that Ja Rule is like the organizer of this thing and is not listed among the performers.
No.
That's when you just know, like, this dude's clearly in on the scam because otherwise, why is he there?
One of the good things that did come out of this is that now for a lot of the influencers, like, because Kendall Jenner got $250,000 to pay to have one ad on her Instagram about this festival.
Mm-hmm.
And something that was interesting to me is like, at no point did anyone imply she was going. Like,
no.
All of these people, like, they were all going to post all this stuff, and then, like, at no point was anyone like, are you actually going to show up at this thing? And then now, like, there are rules about how you have to post it. That's an ad on Instagram, which I guess is some form of progress. But it just, I mean, I thought the Hulu documentary did a really good job about talking about how it really is kind of this influencer FOMO culture of, like, posting all these pictures from this bay of pigs. And, you know, even the guy, the yoga guy in the Hulu one.
Yeah.
I could go on about that guy for like 20 minutes. Yes. Because basically he's like working on all of this. And he's supposed to be teaching yoga to people at Fyre Festival. And it's a whole giant thing. But he's talking about how even while having the most difficult time of his life at Fyre Festival, he's posting these amazing pictures. And people are like, oh man, that looks awesome. Like, what an amazing job you have. And then he's like, it's all garbage. None of it's real. Like,
yeah, because this guy is going through, like, a hellish experience.
And even the people who tried to sleep, like, you know, it was probably a sign that the people who tried to sleep on the beach the first time, like, just to see what it was like. I believe it, one of them is the guy who learned how to fly by doing a Microsoft air simulator. He's like, never sleep on the beach. This is terrible. This is not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And no one listened.
No.
No.
Because a bunch of people posted orange squares on Instagram.
Oh, God. It's...
it's unbelievable how easily people can get just...
I know. It's amazing.
Because, yeah, because you had, like... yeah, like, with the Fear of Missing Out stuff, like, you had, like, that one Instagram influencer, one of the women who, like, is like, this is going to be, like, a historic event.
And yeah.
It's like, okay, yeah, Woodstock, sure. But that was, like, the first one.
Right.
And every other, like, super famous music festival that, like, people remember now, like, either Jimi Hendrix was playing at it or people died.
Right. And I think that was something that people brought up in the festival. Was like, you know, in the Hulu documentary is, like, people don't remember the long lines and how gross Woodstock was. Yeah. People just remember, like, amazing performances. And I'm like, well, Blink 182 was your headliner.
Yeah.
So I'm not really sure where this was going to go from that point.
Yeah, like, you started with good music, but, like, didn't really specify.
Right, and just, like...
Which generally means, like, it's not Kanye.
No. And, I mean, it just is... It's interesting how much of this was focused on creating this entire... this experience. But it was just all, like, oh, we're going to ship in Evian water and have, like, chefs. And then the most famous photograph from this is, like... just a piece of bread with meat and lettuce.
Oh, my God. And a piece of cheese.
Yeah, a piece of cheese. Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's like the worst camp food ever.
Right. And yet you paid thousands of dollars for it.
Because of this, like, cocaine-addled dude who, like, in the middle of running this obvious fraud that is going to fall apart, is like, I want a pirate ship.
Yes. He wanted a pirate ship to show up. And then people rightly told him, no, that's not going to happen.
This is a childish fantasy, sir.
And then apparently while they were having these incredibly intense meetings and everyone else is working like 20 hours a day, he would just leave and then go like ATVing around and then come back as if nothing had happened.
Yeah, just to like blow off steam. Very normal thing to do.
Totally normal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good
times. And also like his mantra with Ja Rule, which I don't even want to...
No, we don't have to repeat that.
It was like, it's not appropriate for a boardroom.
No, it's not appropriate for a boardroom, and it's also like, again, Ja Rule should not be a driving force behind anything.
No.
Like, Shanti never got us into this mess.
No, never, she did not.
A single problem.
And I gotta feel like 50 Cent has been having a good month.
I mean,
I don't know what else is going on in his life, but he's having a good month.
All I know is he's got a Starz show that keeps getting renewed because I see the trailer for it on TV and then it looks involved. And he was right about Ja Rule this entire time.
Yes, the dude was a fraud.
He was the whole time. He was a wank.
He was more of a fraud than we could have ever possibly
imagined.
Like, if
you're 50 Cent, you just be like, I said it. I told you.
Yeah, he should put out an entire album just called I Told You.
Right,
and just
exactly.
And just have, like, 12 tracks about Fire Festival.
Exactly.
He could just read off the detail. He could read, like... Yeah. Quotes from the documentary.
Or
over
from
beats.
The lawsuit.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
The lawsuit, which is just, like... I like how, I believe one of the attorneys from the lawsuit was like, you know, it's kind of funny, but it's actually not funny. But it's kind of funny, but it's not funny.
He was trying to wrestle with it, but, like, you could tell, like, there's no way to frame this in which it's not at least a little bit funny.
Oh, exactly. Exactly.
Because, like, other than Aubrey McClendon, nobody died?
Nope. Fortunately.
Yeah, thank goodness.
Fortunately.
they seem to have dodged a bullet there.
The airport thing could have gone really badly, as could the angry workers thing, as could many other pieces of this. But, so far, yeah, I think that's something about these documentaries also, is that, like, the toll of what this cost people, obviously, is humiliating and expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, there have been grifts that obviously have killed people, many people. And so far, this is just round up with two really entertaining documentaries and Billy McFarlane in prison and Ja Rule tweeting about how it's not his fault.
It's not my fault.
It's not his fault.
And now that, like, the GoFundMes have been put into place for, like, the people in the Bahamas who were just totally scammed.
Oh, God. Yeah.
It's like, okay, good. Now I can, like, feel less bad about enjoying these documentaries.
Exactly.
Because, like, the Instagram people... If you're spending $20,000 to go to a music festival, music festivals, that's a roll of the dice on the experience no matter what.
Exactly.
I've been to Bonnaroo.
Yeah.
Like, it was worth it once.
Yeah.
But, like, I spent $250 on the ticket and went down with a caravan of people.
Right.
Like, I did not spend $20,000 and expect to be treated like royalty.
Especially once people start saying things like, hey, you have wristbands, and you should definitely load thousands of dollars onto your wristband. Like,
it's like, no, this is a music festival. I should be paying $3 for, like, a quesadilla.
Exactly. Exactly. It doesn't have to be a good quesadilla.
No.
It just has to be a quesadilla.
It just has to be sustenance to, like, break up the alcohol.
Right. And then you're supposed, you know, it's also a music festival, which means, like, water should be free.
Yeah, and,
or
like...
Or close to it. To prevent obvious problems.
Yeah, because otherwise...
You're in the Caribbean.
Yeah, people might die.
Right.
Yeah.
Obvious bad problems.
You're on the water. Like, they show like the dude who's waiting in the airport who is covering himself in baby oil because of how sunburned he is. And it's like, yeah, if you had left these people out for another day, we would have lost some people. We definitely would have lost some people.
Right. Yeah.
Except for the person who somehow got a villa.
Okay. Which, again, if anyone who helped make this documentary is listening to this, I just want to know how she got a villa.
Because, like, given the way that other things happened in this documentary, everything is on the table.
Right. And, like, she's just like, well, it sounds like other people had a bad time. But all I know is that would have mean that she had one night in a villa and then flew back. Like,
yeah, they really, they needed to go more into that story than her just being like, ha ha. Like,
I could watch three more of these.
I hope they make, like, they need follow-up documentaries on this. I need like, the lives of these people. I need to know, like Billy McFarlane has his own, like, business music beats, like, in prison.
Yeah.
Like,
which is a very, like, if you have a thing that you're committed to, and for him it's grifting.
Yes.
If you're gonna keep that up while in prison, I appreciate that.
I mean, like, that, you know, can't get into more prison.
It's true. Like, yeah, it's,
you're already there.
You're already there, and that's how he's. That's gonna be go far in his good behavior argument.
Yes.
I really hope
his parole hearings. I hope they're live streamed.
A judge who has seen both of these documentaries will be like, no,
there's not a single word coming out of your mouth.
No, not at all.
But yeah, no, everything involved the Fyre Festival from now forward needs to be broadcast
right.
as far and wide as humanly possible.
Exactly.
Because I need to consume it.
Oh, I absolutely. I'm almost about to go watch the documentaries again, just because there are just so many iconic moments.
Oh, I squeezed in a second viewing of the Hulu documentary before you got here today.
Like when people start getting paid in bags of cash, which is bad.
That's usually a sign that things aren't on the up and up.
They're the app employees, and they're like, oh, we're not even involved in this other nonsense. We're involved in the first initial nonsense.
Yes.
Which we thought was a good idea.
Speaking of the app employees, he tries to lay them off without laying them off.
Right.
And then is like, oh, is that, like, legally an issue that, like, I'm not paying you, but I'm not firing you, so you can't collect unemployment benefits? And the employees are like,
calls,
yes.
These recorded calls are just like, I watched the Netflix documentary with two attorneys, and they just laughed the whole time.
I 100% believe that.
Just comedy event of the century.
It's unbelievable how much of this is documented, given what's going on. Because their policy should have been like, we destroy everything the moment it's created. We have no records.
I mean, it's the Stringer Bell theory of just like, is you taking notes on a criminal conspiracy?
And they didn't just take notes. They filmed it.
They took video of criminal conspiracies.
They couldn't even be like, no, they were talking about another Billy McFarland. Like, no, that's my face.
No, that is you being passed out in the sand holding a beer.
Or me, like, very sketchily after laying out this ticket plan, like, looking at the camera guy and being like, I think that's enough for today. Just like, yeah, it was. It sure was.
It's like, oh, man.
But the New York District Attorney just sitting there like, are you kidding?
Well, especially the New York District Attorney is, like, you know, busy, but not that busy.
Yeah.
Like, this is also the kind of thing, like, especially in that district, like, going after someone like Billy McFarland is, like, that's why they're there.
I assume this is sport for them because, like, I'm sure they're used to, like, more competent crime, too.
Right.
Whereas this is just like, oh, man, like, this is funny.
Right.
Like, by and large, this is hilarious. So I'm sure they're coming through this like, I love this case.
Right, exactly.
Give me more.
Especially because it's just, like, everyone is in agreement of, like, oh, these people are idiots. Like, dumb criminals who talk a lot and write everything down and are filmed saying things.
It's not going to be hard to prove the case.
No.
It wasn't. He's spending 6 years in prison.
Right. It seemed to go really quickly.
Yeah, like, it did not take long.
Even during the course of filming one of the documentaries, he went from not being in prison to being in prison.
Yeah, because it doesn't, like, this did not happen that long ago.
No.
If it really feels like, I mean, I know time moves fast in terms of the amount of events that we just get bombarded with, but, like, it does not feel like that long ago that I saw the cheese sandwich, like, the day that was happening.
Right. I remember the Fyre Festival memes as they were happening, and then more of them happened. And
we've got two, like, fully formed documentaries that cover completely different aspects of this.
Ugh.
And still, there are questions left that could fill probably 4 more documentaries. And if there's a book, I will buy it.
I demand 4 more documentaries and a book. And then, like, another book.
And a movie.
Yeah.
I need all of the Fyre Festival.
We're getting
everything.
A Theranos movie, which...
Oh, my goodness.
Starring Jennifer Lawrence, which makes sense if you kind of look at the two people.
Yes.
But a Fyre Festival movie, it feels like the kind of, like, it has to happen. It absolutely has to happen.
Who do you cast as Billy McFarland?
Well, you need to... Okay. You're going to need to cast someone... Cause
he's got kind of an Adam Sandler vibe. If you gave Adam Sandler some cocaine, he could pull off Billy McFarland.
Well, you need to have... You need to be kind of like... You need to be kind of mendaciously adorable. Like, kind of have the face that says, like... You shouldn't believe me, but people will.
Yeah, there's going to be something about me that you trust, even though you
don't. Yeah, and then you're going to have to gain, 20 pounds.
And then lose it later.
Yeah, you're going to have to gain 20 pounds of nonsense weight. Lose 20 pounds of nonsense weight while hanging out with your model girlfriend and apparently working out all the time because you're working on being a better person.
Yeah, I keep thinking of, maybe Ben Affleck could do it because he's got, the, disheveled, 5 o'clock shadow thing going, but then he also got himself into enough shape to be Batman for a little
while. Right. You need to have someone who's okay with I was trying to think if there's someone young. They'd have to be kind of young and cute in a very distinct
This is the thing, I'm naming people that are too old because Billy McFarland is orange.
Yeah, I think Billy McFarland is
he might be younger.
I think he's 31 or something.
God,
like that.
So yeah, Billy and I are the same age.
We'd need someone young. But the kind of person who their parents would be really proud of, all their childhood scams and didn't realize they were just scams the whole time.
Yeah. Ben Affleck isn't quite cute enough,
no,
I don't think.
It's not going to work. Yeah. I don't know who the young people are.
I'm so out of touch.
Yeah, but no, this should happen.
But we have now done a solid, hour and a half.
Perfect.
And touched on, I think we did a good 3 minutes about basketball. So
that's great.
So
that
gets it onto the MGO feed. That's what we needed.
Yeah. I mean, no one really wants to talk about that Iowa game. I don't want to talk about that Iowa game. Iowa game didn't happen because it got canceled out by MSU losing at home.
Exactly. We got the petty points. We're going to eventually get that into the net rating.
It's about time.
We're going to lobby for that real hard.
There should have been petty points issued for so many moments, Darius Morris and get the fuck off my court.
If we need a beef history of the Darius Morris and Caitlin Lucas. That's what we need SB Nation to work on right now.
I just think that college basketball beef history could just be it would be epic. Because I just love the fact that
Or Tom Izzo versus his own team.
Oh.
I would watch Tom Izzo, Nick Ward beef history.
Tom Izzo v. The Zone. Like 20 minutes on how Tom Izzo doesn't...
Versus his own brain.
I still can't believe Syracuse won that game. I still think about it, and I'm just it's
it boggles the mind every time.
How?
Because I'm now got a little free time on my hands, so I got league pass. And right. So I'll flip on a Grizzlies game every once in a while, and you see Jaren Jackson Jr., and it's that dude wasn't even on the court on a college team regularly.
And...
How?
It's not when John Beilein figured it out in the Final Four and we were that was difficult but impressive because it involved Mitch McGarry doing a bunch of stuff. And now I'm just it's been years.
Yeah,
it's,
and everybody else, Syracuse has not been a particularly strong program for the last 4 or 5 years.
They barely got in the tournament last year.
They've missed 2 of the last 4.
And yet...
Thank you so, so much to Jane Costin for joining me on the Ace Pod 1.2. We apologize for nothing. Play me out, Blink.